case on our docket is Burrell versus Buck, and we're ready to hear from the petitioners.
May I please report? My name is Richard Barkley, and I am arguing today on behalf of Weld County Sheriff and District Attorney. For brevity, I refer to them together as the county, and I will likewise refer to the petitioners collectively as the business. The issue on which this court granted certiorari is whether the search and seizure of records from the office of an unincorporated tax preparation business violated the rights of either the business owner or her clients under the Colorado United States Constitution. The principal criticism of the search and seizure that was articulated by the district court and the principal attack on the search by the business in its brief to this court are that the information supporting the warrant was not sufficiently specific. In the words of the district court, the search was unconstitutional because the warrant lacked probable cause, quote, as to a specific individual.
Mr. Barkley, could I just interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
I apologize. Could you just give us briefly the remedies that were sought in this case? We get some background. It's a civil case.
Yes, Your Honor. It was a civil case that was brought. It was an action for declaratory judgment and for injunctive relief. And this is actually an interlocutory appeal from a grant of a preliminary injunction.
So there were no damages sought?
No, there were no damages sought in this case, although, of course, amendment is always possible.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Anyway, let me repeat the district court's quote. He said the search was unconstitutional because the warrant lacked probable cause, quote, as to a specific individual, as to specific files, as to a specific crime. That statement by the district court illustrates the key question in this appeal. What must be identified with specificity, with particularity, to obtain a constitutionally valid warrant authoring the search at the premises of a business? The answer to that question is the warrant must specify the place that will be searched, the warrant must specify the crime for which the evidence is sought, and the warrant must specify the things to be seized. Now, I'd like to go back momentarily to the basis for the district court's finding. The court said, first, the search warrant lacked probable cause as to a specific individual. But probable cause does not require that a search warrant specify an individual. In Zerker versus Stanford Daily, the United States Supreme Court expressly rejected such a requirement, stating, search warrants are not directed at persons. They authorize a search of places and a seizure of things, and as a constitutional matter, they need not even name the person from whom the thing will be seized. A search warrant need not identify the person in charge of the premises or name the person in possession or any other person as the offender. The second reason given by the district court judge was that the search warrant lacked probable cause as to specific files. But again, that is not a requirement of probable cause. Rather, probable cause only requires specific identification of the place to be searched. In this case, the affidavit...
Mr. Barkley, in terms of that argument, I guess I would like you to focus a little bit more on how we define the place to be searched, because it seems to me that if it's just like how it's defined in the affidavit, that doesn't quite make the argument. In the earlier argument, Justice Coates used the analogy of different people living in a house to be searched. We could all come up, I think, with some other analogies, different apartment units in an apartment building, different storage units in a rental business that rents storage space. I think the question is, what do you use, what do you pivot on in determining what is the place that's involved.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you seem to be arguing it's just, you know, whatever we say it is when we file the affidavit.
Well,
but that seems to fall short, because obviously you can't, you know, have a warrant for search of a city, or perhaps not even for search of an entire apartment building without some special circumstances.
Of course not, Your Honor. The reason that I was discussing the place to be searched was because of the issue of whether the place to be searched was, as we contend, the business, or the place was to be searched, as petitioners contend, each individual file. The best case that I think that addresses that is People versus Martinez. And in that case, the issue was whether the search of a residence included the search of the son's bedroom, for which he claimed, there was disputed evidence actually, that he paid rent. And the court found that the key issue was whether the son's bedroom was objectively under the control of a person other than the person who controlled the other unit. In other words, if there were objective evidence that the son controlled the bedroom and had the ability to exclude the other members of the family, then that arguably could be construed as a separate unit and therefore would require a separate search warrant. But if the person who controlled the common areas of the house also exercised control over the bedroom, then the house is treated as a single unit. And you see this a lot in many of the cases that you talk about. The cases involving apartments is the most common. If the apartments are separately marked and an individual exercises control over them, then that apartment is treated as a single unit. Well, the same, if we apply that analysis here, now I'm not saying that the analysis applies to files, but if you were to apply that analysis here, the files were under the control of the business and therefore would be treated the same way that the remainder of the business would. Now, I know your question was a little different. You can't just sort of say the search is the city of Denver. The most common...
Well, I'm actually a little more interested in...
Sure.
I mean, you use Martinez for a standard.
Sure.
And then you say that if you applied it here, you can predict how, or you
sure.
have a sense of... You have an argument about how that comes out. But then you said that I'm not making that argument. So I guess I would like to understand why you aren't making that argument and what argument you are making about how we decide between the file and the office, which I guess very grossly stated seems to be the difference in the core issue here.
Sure. Your Honor, the issue is whether or not the place to be searched is the business, the physical premises occupied by the business, or whether the search place to be searched is the individual file. I yesterday submitted, and I apologize because it was beyond the time I was supposed to, I submitted a case of supplemental authority called United States versus Alberts that addresses that particular issue. In Alberts, the government had probable cause to believe that an individual named LaVon Alberts possessed evidence of embezzlement, and that Alberts kept the evidence in several large green plastic garbage bags. The affidavit stated that the garbage bags were believed to be stored at the residence of Alberts' aunt. An agent obtained a warrant, identified the place to be searched as the residence of Alberts' aunt. The aunt, when they went to the aunt's residence, she said that she wasn't storing any of Albert's property, but suggested the agent look at the residence of Albert's half-sister. Two agents went to the half-sister's house, told her they had a warrant, and she directed them to the location of the garbage bags. Albert moved to suppress on the grounds that the warrant did not authorize a search of the half-sister's place, and the government said the garbage bags were the place to be searched. The court disagreed, and let me read its language. If it could be said that the garbage bags constituted the place to be searched, the officers would have been justified in searching anywhere that the bags conceivably might have been located. To adopt this position would, in essence, condone the use of a general warrant. Court held that the only place authorized to be searched under this warrant was the residence of Albert's aunt. Now, our situation is very much like that. Search warrants are generally searches of places that most commonly and most broadly is a residence, a business, a physical premises. It is not within something within a physical premises. I'm not saying that it can't in some instances be a storage locker, for example, that's under the control of somebody other than the owner of the facility. But generally, the place to be searched are the premises set out in the affidavit, and the authority to search those for specific items includes the authority to search containers or other objects within the residence that could hold the items to be searched.
I guess I'm missing something here. I thought what we're talking about in this case was, in effect, the expectation of privacy of the person conducting the business and of the clients. And the business, as we heard in previous case, is doing nothing wrong here. In fact, they're complying with the law and the policies of Congress and the IRS. So would you address the fishing expedition piece of this, go right to the heart of it, that in fact this is an intimidation of a lawful business by the government intruding and taking all the files of the business?
Yeah, there are actually sort of two separate issues there, Your Honor. The first is the scope of the seizure. The scope of the seizure really, I don't believe, is complained about here, or the scope of the search to this extent. Everybody agrees that to the extent they had authority to search for evidence of the crime of criminal impersonation or evidence of identity theft, that in order to, there's not a legal problem with looking through a file sufficiently to determine whether or not it contains information relating to that.
Mr. Barkley, can I ask a couple of questions just about relation to that last sentence?
Okay.
Was there any indication in the affidavit that as to why search was sought for 2006-2007 returns?
No, I don't think the affidavit's...
So there was nothing in that regard, is that right?
That explains why it was searched for those 2 years.
As I understand it, at least from the affidavit, there were two services provided by the business. One was tax preparation and the other was translation service. Is that right?
I don't believe that they found any evidence. Well,
no, I just, but
I
they performed these two different functions, right?
The title of the business is translation and tax services, yes.
Was there any discussion in the affidavit as to anything improper about the translation services?
No, but nothing was sought with respect to the translation services. The affidavit sought tax returns for 2006 and 2007 that had mismatched SSNs and IPINs.
Okay, but was there any information? There's no information linking those years, though, right? Was there any information? I think you said yes, there wasn't. Was there any information linking any individual other than the informant, Mr. Trejo, as to having filled out?
No, Your Honor, and let me just mention one thing about that, is that, you know, this is the crime of identity theft, and one of the suggestions in the prior argument is he had to know the name of the individual. Well, there's a real problem with that, of course, because which name of which of the individual are you talking about? Well, the real name or the false name?
Well,
and not only that, but there's no way of knowing how the files are organized within the business. So even if you had all of the individual's correct names, if the files were organized by the false names, you would still have to go through every single file.
and seize all $5,000.
Well, so the seizure of the $5,000 was basically to accommodate the business. They could have conducted the search at the business and reviewed the files there. Had they done so, it would have gravely disrupted the business. And this court's own decision in Gall suggests that the better way is to take the files. And remember what they did when they took the files. They took the files, they put them in a secure location. They reviewed each file to see whether it had an ITIN and an SSN. If it did, that was a file they would go further with. If it did not, they set it aside. They took no notes about it. They took no names. They didn't take the names of it. They took no information about that and returned the file. So the seizure was basically an effort to accommodate the business.
Well, Mr. Barkley, do you think that we should have different standards in terms of the constitutional standards when because we're dealing with a crime of identity theft?
No, I don't think we should have different standards, Your Honor. In fact, what I was attempting to point out is that, in fact, if you look at the three requirements of a search warrant, specifying the place that must be searched, there's no dispute that the place to be searched, the business, was specifically identified. It also must specify the things to be seized. The petitioners have agreed in their brief that there was sufficient specificity as to that. And then the other thing is specification, boy, that's a hard word to say, of the crime. And here, the two crimes at issue were expressly identified in the affidavit. So the position that we take, Your Honor, is that all of the requirements of probable cause were met, and that, in fact, what we're dealing with here is either an attempt to apply other criteria, such as the identification of the individual or the identification of the file, that is not required by probable cause.
Counsel, can I stop you there on this end? You're coming up with your set of requirements, and I'm wondering how the fact that these are tax records might play into that. We have certainly a good deal of authority saying tax records are confidential, and there's some federal guidelines that say they're also protected from other agencies, and I'm wondering how that kind of corpus of law plays into the requirements of probable cause.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we have taken the position that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in tax records, and therefore that it is subject to the probable cause requirements. Beyond that, we take the position that there is no sort of additional or extraordinary kind of standard that would be required to be met. Let me just mention a couple of things that I think were stated incorrectly in the prior argument. The first is that there was a question asked whether or not a warrant could be served on the IRS under 6103. Absolutely, a warrant can be served on the IRS if there is probable cause. Second, there was the issue of whether under 7212 a warrant could be served on the tax preparer.
Let me just back you up for a moment with that claim or statement that you just made that a warrant could be served on the IRS. Would you argue that based on the information in the current affidavit, it could be served on the IRS? Because it seems to me you have an affidavit that establishes that some records or some tax returns have been filed which may use ITN records for illegitimate purposes with respect to or with regard to associated with the illegitimate use of Social Security numbers. That would seem to apply to the tax preparer office and also to the IRS, I guess. So you're saying that you've got probable cause and an affidavit sufficient to get a warrant on the IRS at the present time?
asking for all tax returns that have mismatched ITINs and SSNs, is that, so, I mean, what would the warrant ask for?
Well, that's what, it's your warrant. What I'm hearing you say is that you currently have an affidavit that establishes sufficient information for probable cause, and if I understand your argument, that you really only need it for some files, you don't need it for all the files, you seem to have the same thing on the IRS that you have on the tax preparer here.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, there are sort of two responses to that. The first is that with respect to probable cause, I'm not sure what the scope of the warrant would be, and anybody who would serve an serve a search warrant on the IRS to search for all files would have to be out of their mind.
I'm a little startled by your claims. Maybe you can explain
The IRS,
what you were trying to communicate.
They would have the same information the tax preparer would. They'd have the W-2s with the Social Security number, and they'd have the ITIN number. So theoretically, you could make such a search warrant on basically the same information for all the taxpayers in Weld County.
Seeking the same information of all taxpayers in Weld County.
Sure.
Have an ID.
That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, all employers in Weld County. And same thing, right? Every private business that may hire somebody, there may be some of this going on. Therefore, the same kind of search warrant could be directed at all businesses, legitimate businesses in Weld County, correct?
Let me just respond to that, because I frankly think that with respect to the employers, your question assumed that because we know that some employers hire individuals.
Well, let's if you don't mind, Justice Hobbs, let's just start with the IRS, where we have exactly the same kind of information that we had at this tax service. That is contradictory information, an SSN and an ITIN number that don't match
within
IRS would have all that information in the same way that she did. So you have the same warrant. You serve it on the IRS, seeking to go through tax returns in Weld County to see whether or not there are these differences. That's okay, you said?
No, I mean, the first question I'd ask is what was the place to be searched?
It would be the IRS.
Well, the IRS is located in thousands of places. Could I go to an individual IRS? Let's say the IRS had an office in Weld County that is the location where people sent the returns to Weld County. Could I then go to that IRS office and serve a search warrant on them for all of the Weld County filings that had mismatched ITINs and SSNs? Yes, I believe I could. Now, of course, here, returns aren't sent to Weld County, so I don't frankly know where jurisdiction would even exist to search it on the serve on the IRS. Second, there's no place to be that's been identified, and I'm not sure where those files would be held. But beyond that problem, I believe so. Under the law, we could ask that from the federal government. Yes. It looks like I'm out of time. I'm sorry, Justice Hobbs. I didn't want to continue.
Thanks.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Liz Harris. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs in the trial court, Amalia Cirillo.
Could you speak up a little louder, please?
You can adjust that podium and go. There's a toggle switch. It goes up or down.
Yes, I see. It seems too complicated. I'll just lean over. Look, there is no nice way to characterize this search. This is a classic fishing expedition. That's what all four judges in the district court said. And Justice Martinez, I want to start with your question because I do think that this is central. The government wants to come in here and say, look, we have these generic principles that we can stack one on top of the other and get to this outrageously aggressive result. And here's part of how we're going to do it. We're going to come in and tell you that the office is the place to be searched, and we have probable cause to believe that there's evidence of a crime in the office. That's fine. Let's say that the place is the office. That's what you've got probable cause of, that somewhere in the office there's evidence of a crime. Let's say that. That's not the end of the Fourth Amendment or Article II, Section 7 analysis. That's the beginning, because every single search under the Fourth Amendment and Article II, Section 7 has to be reasonable. There's a preliminary point here that I cannot stress enough, and that is these taxpayers had a reasonable expectation of privacy in their files. So what you're starting with in this office is 5,000 separate spheres of privacy that are constitutionally protected under Article II, Section 7, and under the Fourth Amendment.
That seems to get right to the point of our argument here. But as reading the briefs, I had trouble finding any authority that was that narrow. Do you have something you can point us to, or are you asking us to make a distinction that's not yet been made?
No, I think that, Your Honor, in every case, courts balance under a reasonableness test to see what is the level of intrusion and what is the government interest. And when you're determining what the level of intrusion is, you have to say to the officers, what are you coming here with? Last term, the Supreme Court of the United States decided that student strip search case. And in that case, they said, a search can't be reasonable if the content of the suspicion fails to match the degree of the intrusion.
Reasonableness is a pretty broad problem, and we deal with it in lots of contexts. Could you bring us down to some authority, either from the United States or from our court or some other persuasive court, that has found that it would only be reasonable to search an individual file in an office if there's probable cause to believe that particular file contains evidence of a crime?
Well, there's no case directly on point. But yes, there are cases that say when you have separate zones of privacy and the government comes with a warrant that is a sort of general place to be searched warrant, that's not allowed. And the easiest example of that in this court, you cannot say the place to be searched is an apartment building. You might have all the probable cause in the world to believe that somewhere in that apartment building there is evidence of a crime. But this court says, that's all true, but you can't get a warrant to break down each of the doors. That's an unreasonable search under the circumstances.
Maybe I could bring you to just a little narrower to our situation. Let's take the situation of search of the lawyer's office or the real estate agent, whatever, which we do have some cases on. It seems to me, maybe I'm misconstruing those, but the U.S. Supreme Court has approved a search of files in that office, even though it is clear most of the files which belong to other individual clients do not contain, or we have no reason to believe they would contain evidence of a crime. But we have reason to believe some of the files do contain evidence of a crime. We have allowed searches of the office under certain constraints in those situations, have we not? And so what is the difference here?
Okay, the difference here, and I think Justice Costa, you're referring to cases like Anderson, and there's another case that we cited, Hayes, which had to do with a medical office. There are a number of differences that I think make a real analytical distinction here. The first is that in those cases, of course, you have another piece of the puzzle because you have a suspect in that case. Here, you had no suspect. The only information that the officers had in this case was that somewhere, someone might have been committing a crime, evidence of which would have been found in some file. But in Anderson and Hayes and those cases, you have an extra piece here. You have some sort of individualized suspicion about something. In that case, of course, it's the target of the search.
Well, and so if in this case, the sheriff's conducted exactly the same search on the basis that their informant, Mr. Cahill, had his tax returns done, that would be okay? Even though they go through 5,000 other files to find his file?
You're saying if they had suspected Ms. Cerillo of a crime, would that same search?
No, let's say she's entirely doing her job. But they had, I forget the man's name, I thought it was Tejo or something like that.
Trejo, yes.
Trejo, okay. Who was the informant who said, I did this, and she did my tax return. So it would have been okay if they were looking for his file?
Okay, well, I think that brings up an interesting issue. Of course, it's not presented in this case because it's interesting, the warrant never asked for Servando Trejo's file. So clearly...
I'm asking you to hypothesize.
Right.
What if it did, would that satisfy your concern?
And I think that if they had some individualized suspicion, which we agree they did about Servando Trejo, they could then go in, they have probable cause as to that file, and get that file. Now, the question becomes trickier, which is, well, what's a reasonable way of getting that file? And there's case law in the Tenth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit that says, look, if you've got this kind of probable cause with respect to a very narrow zone of privacy, it's not reasonable to then intrude on all the other zones of privacy. So the best way to do it is to set up some sort of a procedure that prevents that. This comes up most often in computer cases. And courts say, no, it's not reasonable to open every single file in order to find Servando Trejo's as a matter of investigative technique. But what you could do is take the files, set up some third person, bring it to the court maybe, and have them go through and pick out Servando Trejo's file.
Well, I don't think we're going to want the courts going through 5,000 files.
Well, but in many cases, Justice Malarkey, they do set up procedures, particularly with respect to computers where the commingling problem is an issue. Here, of course, they didn't have probable cause as to any file except Servando Trejo, which they were not even seeking in the first place. So commingling is a little bit of a red herring in this case. But they did have probable cause, and if they had wanted to get Servando Trejo's file, they could have. They would have had to have executed a reasonable search in order to get Servando Trejo's file, because every step of the intrusion has to be reasonable. So
as I understand the facts here, it was that the files were not... were organized in some other way. They weren't organized according to the information that the sheriff was seeking. Is that correct?
That's right. They were not organized in one cabinet that said Social Security number and ITIN numbers. Not surprisingly, they were organized by name of client. And so without any information about who they were looking for, what file they were looking for, who had committed what crime, what kinds of evidence might be in any particular file, they just opened every single one of the files, and in doing so, they intruded upon 5,000 separate spheres of privacy. And
is it your position that they went beyond the terms of the warrant in and of itself?
No, the warrant here is invalid because...
But assuming that the warrant was valid or invalid, it doesn't matter. Just the language of the warrant, did they go beyond, did their search go beyond what they were allowed to do so?
The warrant here authorized a fishing expedition, which is the problem. So they did not go beyond what the warrant authorized. The warrant authorized searching through every single person's reasonable expectation of privacy.
Did they get years which they weren't authorized to get, for example?
Yeah, the notion...
So in that sense, they went beyond the terms of the warrant?
Right. The notion that this was such a minimal search, that they didn't look at anything, is belied by the factual record, which suggests, in fact, they did, because they relied in the district court, in the criminal cases, on all of these tax returns that had been taken under a plain view exception.
Did they have the authority to seize the computer? Was that authorized in the warrant?
One of the problems that was identified by the district court in this case is that the warrant said you can take all of the computers, any kind of computer equipment, out of the office, which they did. There was no narrowing, no particularity in terms of what they were looking for on the computer. The argument in the district court was, well, you should know by the affidavit that we were just looking for the same client files. They had no more probable cause to take electronic client files than they did to take the paper files. So they had no probable cause to look in the computers. And in any case, the district court here found that the part of the warrant that authorized the seizure of the computers was way overbroad because it never said what the officers were allowed to look for on the computers.
When you say they had no probable cause, now, I didn't think you were making an argument that there was not probable cause to believe the files or computers in this office contained evidence of a crime, but simply that it had to be more particularized with regard to the specific probable cause identified to a specific file. Or is that right?
That's right. And it gets back to this reasonableness test, because really you can think of particularity as kind of a sliding scale. When you are entering a place that has 5,000 separate zones of privacy, the particularity requirement is going to be much more important. And that's why their reference to Zerker doesn't hold up. This case is not Zerker. This case would have been Zerker if in Zerker the officers thought that the photo of the student protest were located in one of 50 backpacks. that the staff members had left at the newspaper office, in which they retained a reasonable expectation of privacy. And then they got a warrant to search the newspaper office and opened every single backpack to try to find the photo. That's not a reasonable search. The search under Zuerker was reasonable because in weighing all of the facts and circumstances and in identifying one specific zone of privacy that was going to be intruded upon, the officers there had enough information. There's just not enough suspicion here to match up to the level of intrusion.
Can I ask you one follow-up on that? Since you raised Zuerker, though, that clearly is a case in which there was no probable cause to believe the holder of the information was committing a crime or was targeted. Is that right? So is that not essential? Is that not an important part of your argument that there was no probable cause to believe that the tax preparer was committing a crime?
It's a factor to be considered in the balancing. And here, it's even more egregious that they went into these client files because they didn't think anything illegal was going on at that office. And nothing illegal was going on at the office. And I do want to just clarify a couple of things about how this whole ITIN system works, because I think it got a little off track there. The general rule is that everybody has to file taxes. Even if you're here as an undocumented worker, everyone has to file taxes, and everybody needs a tax number to file with. So American citizens and other people who are here legally working get a Social Security number. And the IRS says, well, we certainly don't want to lose all of that tax revenue, so we are going to assign a number to the people who are not here working legally but who are earning wages. And in order to get that number, you have to send in your W-2 and also send in a proof of your actual identification. So now the government knows you're working under a Social Security number that's not yours, and they give you an ITIN number. That way they can allocate the taxes. So this is a way that the government can not just get all the money it's entitled to, but can solve this problem of having taxes that are coming in on a false Social Security number not being allocated correctly.
Can I just interrupt you there? Because that's the part that I've always been confused about. So you have your W-2 with a Social Security number. You have a proof of identification.
Correct.
And then you have an ITIN.
Right.
The proof of identification goes, does the IRS care whether any of these things match up? Does the proof of identification match up with the W-2, with the ITIN?
Right. What happens is
you
send in your proof of identification, and they say, okay, you're the taxpayer.
But this person who's earning the income or the person who's filing? The name that's earning the income or the name that's filing the tax?
The name that's filing the tax. And then they match up an ITIN to the name of the person, the real name of the person who's filing the taxes. And now they can see that the money, the wages that are coming in under the other person's name and Social Security number need to be accounted for with this person's name and ITIN number.
Do they run Social Security numbers to see if there's somebody else filing income tax under that Social Security number?
The IRS has made a decision that what they want to do is not put taxpayers in a catch-22 situation. So they don't want to say to taxpayers, you must file your taxes, you must give us all of this information, but at the same time, tell taxpayers that the information is going to be used against them. So what they do is say, look, give us your real identity, we'll give you a number, you can file the taxes, and we promise that information will be confidential. And in that way, they have struck a balance. They've decided that it is more important to get in the revenue than it is to make law enforcement and immigration enforcement much easier for police officers.
Well, that's really Congress's decision, isn't it?
That is Congress's decision.
It's not the IRS's decision.
Right, but and IRS has set up a whole scheme to implement that policy decision that Congress has developed.
You're not suggesting, however, that they immunize people who use somebody else's identification, are you, from being guilty of a crime?
No, not at all. I'm just saying that they have to pay taxes under the law. And Amalia Cirillo is following federal and state law by assisting them in filing their taxes.
Do they immunize tax preparers for assisting people, or what could be considered aiding and abetting or assisting in the use of someone else's identification to acquire a benefit?
She's not aiding and abetting identity theft, and there's never been any allegation that she's done anything wrong. What she's doing is following this very precise federal process that says you're going to get a number assigned to you, even though we know you're working under a fake Social Security number. You're going to file your taxes using that number. If you have a refund coming to you, it will go to you under your ITIN number. If you don't, thank you very much for the revenue, and we'll take it, and now we know who the wage earner really is. She's not doing anything wrong by following those rules.
Well, it does sound like you're saying they immunize her. They're saying you can do this whether it violates the state law or not. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know that it does violate the state law. I'd be surprised to learn that that violates the state law, but if it does, she would certainly have a very good defense if she's
following. And I don't know either, but the statute we're talking about just talks about knowingly using somebody else's identification to acquire a benefit. That's right, isn't it?
And Amalia Cirillo is not knowingly using anybody's...
If she assists somebody else to knowingly use that to acquire a benefit, is she in violation of that crime as a complicitor under our statutes?
What she's doing is assisting taxpayers in filing their taxes, and that's it. And she made very clear at the hearing in this case that she doesn't ask people any information about Social Security numbers, where they come from, ITINs. She doesn't have any knowledge of that. That's not her
area. Okay, so then you're saying she doesn't know whether they're doing this. I thought the facts were such that it was accepted that she does know.
Well, I think that there can be a presumption by the IRS and by Congress that tax preparers may have access to the information. What she knows is that there's a Social Security number and an ITIN. She does know that. What she knows beyond that, I don't know, and she says that she does not ask a lot of questions about that because that has nothing to do with her job as a tax preparer. The important thing here, though, is that the officers in this case represented to the judge who issued the warrant that there was no illegality at all here concerning Amalia.
Well, in addition, you have a cooperative runner of this business. It's pretty obvious in the affidavit that she's been forthcoming about what she's doing. And secondly, on this question about how it was reasonably or not reasonably carried forth, she certainly is a person appears to have been able to give the information about how to locate a specific file, for instance, the informants. For the investigation of the informant. But isn't much of this answered in your case based on the fact that the prosecution is not seeking to prosecute her? They're not...
Right. They've never alleged that she's done anything illegal or that anything illegal has even occurred at that office because I think someone pointed out that the crime of identity theft is complete. There's no illegality going on at the office at all. Amalia Cirillo is not implicated in any crime. That's what makes the search so unpalatable here. Every judge to have looked at the warrant has said, really, you're going to invade 5,000 separate...
Not every judge. Well, yeah. Some of them signed it.
Well, that's true.
Which actually gets to my question. What if at all does good faith, the whole problem with good faith, how does that impact your case? Because a district court judge signed this warrant. And we want to encourage, obviously, police officers to come to the courts to have their warrants reviewed before they go out and do searches. They were doing what the police officers were doing what they were supposed to do here.
Let me answer that in two ways, Justice Rice. First of all, we obviously agree with the judges who said this was such a bare bones kind of an affidavit. If you're trying to get into 5,000 separate files, this was not enough, and no reasonable officer could have thought it was.
But a reasonable judge found that it was, and that's what I want you to hone in on precisely.
Okay, but that occasionally happens, that a judge signs a warrant, and then upon reflection, courts say, yeah, actually, you should have known, and the judge should have known. And in this case, the judge should have known, and the officer should have known. There are 5,000 separately demarcated files. This is not the Dresser case.
Why couldn't the police officers rely upon that judge? I mean, there was argument in the last case that, you know, the police officer should have known the status of the law and whatnot. And, of course, you could make exactly those same arguments with respect to the judge who signed this warrant. I mean, isn't that, in fact, what the officers are doing when they come to a judge and say, would you check this over and see whether it's okay?
Right, and occasionally the system fails, and here it fails.
All right, go ahead.
They are taking a really, really aggressive position. Their position is that on this information, not only can they go to the IRS and clean out their files, which of course they cannot under the statute, and at the preliminary injunction hearing, their own expert testified that, of course, they could not get a warrant for the IRS files on this information. But it's not just the employers who they can go to with this warrant. They can go to H&R Block. Now we've got 21 million tax files that they can pick through. But it doesn't even stop there. I mean, on their theory, and what the judge in this case allowed the officers to do was essentially to say, you know what, I have great probable cause to believe that on Amtrak train number 914, there is marijuana. And now, please, I would like a warrant to search every person's luggage on the train. And the judge said, okay. That's a failure of the system. That's not reasonable. No reasonable officer would have thought he could walk onto the Amtrak train and open everybody's piece of luggage. But that's exactly what happened.
Can I go back to Justice Rice's question just briefly, since you emphasize so much the judges who have done this? If members of this court were to believe that there actually is probable cause, do you think it would be reasonable for a majority to say a reasonable officer could not believe what members of the Supreme Court believe?
Can you say your question again?
Would it be fair to say an officer was necessarily behaving unreasonable to believe there was probable cause if members of the Supreme Court believe there's probable cause?
No,
or would you just say the members of the Supreme Court were wrong or didn't act in good faith in that situation either?
Well, in this case, first let me answer it, just backing up one second. In this case, I think it was perfectly reasonable for the officers to believe that there was probable cause of evidence of some crime in that office that didn't make the search reasonable under the precise circumstances, and that's what matters. And if I may not be understanding your question precisely, but if the question is, if you decided that it was a reasonable search, that particularity, that's all you needed here, just some general sense that there's
No, don't waste your time answering that question, because the question is really specific. What if three people think this was a good search, four people on this court think it wasn't a bad search, four people who think it wasn't a good search say, and it was done in bad faith? His question is, what about the three who said it was a good search? Does that establish good faith?
So you're saying if reasonable minds can disagree about this, why doesn't that establish good faith? Well, in our case, I will say we are removed from the good faith exception because what we had here was, and I think that's a tough question.
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, this is a civil case with a preliminary injunction, and it was not decided under a good faith.
I understand, but just answer the question if you could, please.
I think that's a tough call. I think that these are tough calls in many cases, and I think that reasonable people can disagree a lot when a judge signs a warrant. And I think here, though, we are not really at a place, given the information that the judge got, that this was a reasonable search. And I think the officers have a duty to know whether or not they are conducting a reasonable search or not. I see that I am out of time. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.